Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his friend who is just so goddamn beautiful that if he was to do a painting of me, his art teacher would say he made it up, Duncan Nickel.
And we are returning to a familiar place for me. Very long-term listeners of the show will know, because we covered this in our second ever episode. My favorite fantasy novel of all time is Strange the Dreamer by Lainey Taylor. And whenever people talk about Strange the Dreamer online, they say, oh, Lainey Taylor, that's the woman who wrote Daughter of Smoke and Bone. And up to this point, I had no idea why. Why is this the book that stands out to people?
We're here to find out. But Geordie, before we get into that, have you been reading, experiencing, watching anything else that's been fantasy that you want to share with us?
I would like to go second, because I kind of have a big thing.
I like the assumption there that my thing isn't big. You don't know what I'm going to say. My thing could be amazing.
I don't. I'm going to take an educated guess. And if I'm wrong, you can tell me so, and I will be very embarrassed.
Deal. So, Geordie, this last week, a few little tidbits for me. Firstly, not fantasy related, I saw Hamilton for the first time on stage. Guess what? Pretty good.
Brilliant. Yes, it is fantastical in that it's a, you know, slightly optimistic look at American politics.
That's one way to put it. It was very nice, particularly for someone who is not overly familiar with, if I say source material, don't know if that's the right phrase, real world history. It was nice to get a nice cliff
note. Yeah, you're not that familiar with the Federalist Papers.
So, and no, the music is amazing. It really did strike me how, like, oh, this is what Lin-Manuel Miranda can do when he has, you know, time. Mm. And it's not being kicked right from project to project.
Because, of course, now he's sort of Disney's go-to guy when it comes to, we need to make a new big hit musical. We need to make Moana, we need to make Encanto. Who should we get? Oh, of course, our guy, Lin-Manuel.
Absolutely. Let's get him in. Let's give him 6 months. I'm sure it will be just as good as Hamilton. But yeah, no, Hamilton was amazing. Another bit of actual fantasy that I've been experiencing. Geordie, as you're aware, I have Kindle Unlimited at the moment. And my actual, like, free, reduced price trial lasted 3 months. And it just ticked over at the start of this month. And I was like, oh, do I keep it? Do I not? I ended up keeping it because there was just a few key reads. I was like, no, I need to finish these. One being today's book. And the second one, Geordie, I have dived into what I would probably say may be the origins, or early days at very least, of science fantasy.
Ooh, okay.
And I do think...
How old school are we talking then? Like, ooh, 1920s?
Bang on. Do you want to have an educated guess? Is that enough for you?
Well... Surely not, like, I mean, C.L. Moore was definitely doing something like science fantasy in her her space captain who met up with Jiril of Joyry. Is it him?
It is not, but that's a very good deep cut to go for. But no.
What is it, Dunk?
I was reading Edgar Rice Burroughs' The Princess of Mars. Well, not actually The Princess of Mars. Which, by the way, actually came out in 1912, so sorry, I did mislead you. I've been reading Dynamite's Comics adaptations of Princess of Mars and his John Carter series.
Sure, sure, sure.
Oh, Geordie, they are interesting and they've really hit, like, the spectrum of quality. But it was very interesting reading these. By the way, a lot of Dynamite comics, they're available on Kindle Unlimited because they don't have their... They're not quite big enough to have their own... like service, so that's where they get dumped, at least here in the UK. Sure. Being very nice, catched up with all the Red Sonja. But what's really interesting about these stories is that you've got the original books by Burroughs, which are very white saviour narrative, if I had to describe them personally. Maybe, yeah, there's nuance, but I think that's what it is, personally. But what Dynamite did, once they were done adapting the original material, they went, right, we want to expand on this, how do we do that? And what they did is they picked up the damsel in distress character, John Carter's love interest, Deja Thoris, and they give her a prequel series. And it's very, very interesting to see a comic book run and a comic book character, to be fair, do something very similar to Red Sonja and take the line between when you're dealing with like a scantily dressed sword heroine and it's like empowerment, exploitation. And it's been fascinating to read through the multiple series with this character and see Dynamite very efficiently seem to just jump from each side of that line, like continuously, that they've got a little switch. Like, what should we do for this sub-series? Exploitation today. Very interesting, very interesting.
Okay, gotcha. So it's like, it's, you know, it's the Black Widow treatment. You know, it's like, okay, cool badass, all right, and now eye candy. Back and forth. Flip, 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 flip.
Very much so. But I would just say, like, for John Carter, I actually think we may now cover this on this podcast one day as science fantasy, and I do think it's science fantasy, just because it's very interesting to have a series where it's dated, but it has some interesting forward-thinking ideas. Definitely a four-time caveat. The comic book does something to, like, mellow it, but the original worked, dear God, for the time caveats all around. But it does have an interesting world and an interesting history, and I like these aliens that we encounter. So, good pulpy adventure overall, but oh boy, do they kind of run the gambit on it.
Okay, well, Duncan, that sounds really interesting. I look forward to us looking into John Carter in the future because it does intrigue me. I read a little bit of Tarzan a while back. I didn't make it very far in, probably because the podcast distracted me, but I really liked what I read back then, and I didn't even get to, like, the exciting fighting monkeys bit. I was just at the, like, Tarzan's parents dealing with pirates bit.
It's a really interesting one. Ed Burroughs, I love his writing. It definitely has a lot of problematic themes and ideas within it, but that guy knew how to get that kind of adventure, adrenaline, blood-pumping kind of... I don't know, it's very hard to kind of put a pin on it, what it is that makes it so sort of... not epic, but each individual fight, even when it's small scale, even with just two people wrestling over a knife, has that kind of feel of like grandiose terms.
I think the word you're looking for, Duncan, is swashbuckling.
That probably is the word. They are excellent swashbucklers. And when they're swashbucklers with basically naked people on a faraway planet, isn't it even better? But Geordie, what have you experienced that was so big it had to be saved to a second?
I guess I'll do two things since we are talking about stuff we read. The thing I've read or at least started reading is I'm now moving on through the Foundation series. I'm now reading Second Foundation.
The third book.
And I'm enjoying it. Yes, the third book. Or unless you decide to read one of the prequels, I guess. I'm enjoying it so far. I feel like it's to the point where, at a certain point in the second book, Foundation and Empire, you just sort of get used to the boring bits. You're just like, yes, yes, this too shall pass. And I feel like we're now at a sort of comfortable level of, we're at a sort of passive level of, this is very dry, but it's smooth. It's both dry and smooth, like a solid piece of marble, which for some reason you're eating.
That is a fantastic metaphor, mate. I'm not quite sure if I agree with it or what it's driving at, but sure, it's the writing style is not swashbuckling adventure, but it's not also not
no.
Turgid, to use your favourite insult.
Definitely not. But I'm still working my way through that. I haven't finished it. I'm still developing my opinions on it. So far, so good, though. The bigger thing, and this is where I got a little ahead of myself by saying that I think my opinion's more important, but about 10 minutes ago, before recording this episode, I finally finished my novel.
Oh, congratulations, mate. I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, this is my third novel. It's the first one I've written which is not fantasy, so I guess I shouldn't even really be mentioning it at this point in the show.
Sacrilege.
But I'm very pleased that it's done. I look forward to, after I take my holiday, I'm going hiking, I look forward to going back, looking through it, and making some vicious edits, because I was like, this is going to be a short one. It's going to be 85,000 words, by far the shortest thing I've ever written. And now we've creeped up towards the 110,000 word mark, and I'm like, it's still the shortest thing I've ever written, but it's much too long for what it should be.
I mean, is this the stage to give you a like sales pitch, or just give us a little hint? Just what is the hook for this? What genre is it, if not fantasy?
That's a good question. I don't know what genre it is, because it's sort of like a romance, but they don't get together in this book. It's like, it's cute, but they don't get together at this point. It's about a band. It's about a guy who gets kicked out of the band that he's been in since high school or secondary school. And, like, this is, like, after they, like, went to the same university to keep the band together. And then he's been kicked out. And he feels very lost and detached and divorced from his music. But then a coincidental meeting leads him to start a new one, which pushes himself forward in his, like, in his musical journey, and his journey to become more confident and more sure of himself. And it just so happens that it's also the path that's going to lead to him, like, falling in love. So it's all of that stuff together, wrapped up in a chance meeting.
Oh, that's just so... is it wrong for me to say that just sounds so cute or so horrible?
That's what I'm kind of going for, so, yeah. Anyway, I'm excited about it. Look forward to making some changes. But before we do anything like that, we're here, we're on a mission. It's time to talk about Lainey Taylor, Daughter of Smoke and Bone.
That's right, Daughter of Smoke and Bone. And I really need to get this out the door, like, so people do not call me a hypocrite. Yes, this is a X of Y and Z novel title.
Yes.
All right, I know it is. I saw it, I thought, oh gosh, Daughter of Smoke and Bone? We have children of Blood and Bone just the other day, or whatever it's called. This is not this. I'm sorry, Lainey Taylor, come on now. This is not original. And then I looked at the date of publication, and I went, 2011. You predate A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Yes.
I will step back. You can have this one.
Yeah, and X of Y and Z, a bowl of mac and cheese, was probably still a thing even before A Court of Thorns and Roses, but it definitely wasn't as...
prolific, annoying, everywhere.
Basic bitch. Yeah, I mean, it was just, I have read books, or rather, I've read the title of books, where I have literally been tricked into thinking it is an Akotar book. And I feel like that was very deliberately on purpose. They're trying to trick people into picking it up, reading the blurb, and then getting interested. And, I mean, that's despicable. It's
not going to give you the same vibe.
It's bad for publishing and it's bad for readers.
Do you remember going to like a supermarket when you were younger, like in the answer and in the D section, there'd be a DVD that's just designed to make you think it's like a more popular movie. I'm trying to think seen once just a DVD on the rack called like it on a simple thing called Tangled. It was called Tangled Up. Just there to trick you.
Yeah, and not even to trick people. It's like to trick grandma, you know? It's there to try and get someone who maybe not be as tuned in to literally buy something on accident. That's certainly the case with movies like that. And it's something comparable with X of Y's and Z's, A Bowl of Mac and Cheese.
Another point I actually just want to make before we really dive into the book itself. Jordan, when I was looking at this, so this book was published in 2011, so this is before the Strange to Dreamer duology. And it's worth noting, this trilogy came out earlier. Also, I can't help but notice, and maybe you can shine some more light on this for me, or maybe you're as in dark as I am, Lainey Taylor published 5 novels over 7 years, between 2011 and 2018, with the last one being Muse of Nightmares, the second in the Strange to Dreamer duology.
Mm.
It's been 7 years since... far than where she's not put out another book. Now, she doesn't have to, and to be brutally honest, if she did Strange to Dream and went, right, that's my magnum opus, hanging up my hat, I'm not topping that, fair play, respect. But yeah, do you know what's going on? Any announcements?
I was gonna look at her Instagram today to see if she is working anything, but Instagram didn't load, so I forgot to. But I will say this, is that I read the author's note at the end, and, oh, not even an author's note, there was an interview in the audiobook. And in it, she said, you know, writing doesn't actually come that easy to me. I'm a pretty slow writer. So I think it does kind of make sense to be like, okay, yeah, she's obviously doing other stuff in her life. And she probably is working on something, but she just goes at it slow. And, well, so it goes.
No, fair enough. And do you know what? If you're going to take a break, I think it's very good taste to finish a series and then give people an ending and then take a break, rather than, you know, having written, say, Strange the Dreamer and waiting just random date out of the air, 14 years and counting, for a sequel to a fantasy series you love. Anyway.
Duncan, are you a bit put out by the fact that the first quote, the first thing you read when you pick up this book is, "Praise for Daughter of Smoke and Bone. Wow, I wish I had written this book." Patrick Rothfuss.
Might have been related. Might have just...
I bet you do, Pat. I bet you had written this book or a book. Anyway, I can't be mad at him. I haven't read any of his books.
Maybe one day we will. Honestly, sorry. I'm going to go down a dark rabbit hole here of just like, I can't even believe he's still considered like a great author. It's been so long. He didn't even put out that much beforehand. What has he written? At least George R. R. Martin put out something. He's got two books. Two. Anyway. Daughter of Smoke and Bone. Romantasy? YA? Pretty good.
Yeah, it's all those things. But I should specify, you can call it romantasy, but I think this would be more appropriate to call it paranormal romance. And the reason I choose that specific language is that if this is 2011, we're not talking about Sarah J. Maas. We're talking about Twilight. You know, that's more the sort of era this is coming out. There was a period of time where the hot thing was not fairies or dragons or raunchy sex. It was dating werewolves and ghosts and zombies. And in this case, an angel.
Yes, and it definitely has... I can see, though, I think this book, for me at least, very much seem to strike the middle ground. Although it certainly has less of the sort of the raunchy sex, the sort of the hot passion, as I'll call it, that you see in something like Court of Thorns and Roses. I definitely think it was more moving in that direction than straight up from when we read Twilight, where everything seemed a little bit more standoffish and a little bit more talking of like mere, I don't know, say mere, that's the wrong word. Just like, I love you so much. Oh my god, they're so beautiful. Although the angel in this is just described as perfectly beautiful. I don't think that added much. This, at least I felt like a little bit more warmth and passion. There were a few scenes in the last third, which I'm like, okay, excellent. They do touch each other and not just stare dreaming at each other from afar. That's fun. Go on, Peter. You liked it, George?
So. Yeah, I did like this book.
I liked it too.
I was actually a bit iffy on it at points. I there were some points I was like, oh, I'm not sure about this. Oh, this was definitely written before Strange the Dreamer. But I feel like it came together at the end. Especially like the last part, where everything starts to sort of get tied together. That section as a whole is just written better than the rest of the book, but it's also more interesting, it's more dramatic, it's where you really see the chemistry and the sparks fly, and all that stuff means that even though I think this book does sort of lull in the middle and it slows down, big spike at the end, and also has a big surprise surprise from the woman who wrote Strange Dreamer, big cliffhanger at the end.
I very much agree. This book, very curious. I enjoyed it the whole way through. I never fell off the enjoyment train. But this book was very interesting because I actually felt like it seems very much a book of multiple parts. Even the way it was written and the type of novel it presented itself to be seemed to transition. Reading the opening chapters of this, I knew nothing going into this other than who Liani Taylor is. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know what this was about. I didn't know really the genre, the subgenre I was going for. So the opening sections, I was like, oh, this is much more subdued. Is this going to give me, I don't know. For some reason, because it was so relatively, air quotes come in here, guys, grounded, it's giving me more like Rivers of London vibe. You know, this is about someone with this fantasy elements, but in the real world, are they going to solve a case? I was like, I genuinely was like, maybe this is going to be a murder mystery plot, or maybe this is going to have espionage elements, or are we going for Fallout epic fantasy? Like, I didn't know what type of story I was in, and to be honest, I didn't really know what type of story I was going to get until maybe even halfway before I suddenly went, oh, okay, cool. It's Twilight's romantasy. Yes. But it took about halfway until I even like realised that's what we were going for or moving towards. Do you have a similar experience?
I feel like what I realised around a similar point to you, Duncan, and maybe you're describing the same thing as me, is I realised that we weren't actually going to get like an adventure. What I realised, and I think this is a fair complaint, and it's probably a complaint that a lot of people might and could levy against this book, this is really just a prologue. This is setting the pieces up for the actual story that's going to happen in the subsequent two books. And that could be a real downer for some people. It almost was for me, but I feel like I'm locked in. I'm interested. I want to see what happens next. But I could definitely understand someone being like, really? That's it? That's what happens in this book?
There's certainly a lot of elements, and we'll go into and expand on Paul Neffing that we're sort of talking about behind the curtain here in a second. There's a lot of characters and elements in this book, which I was very unsure starting out. I was like, are you important? Are you what this is about? Our main character has this ex-boyfriend that at the very start of the book has some very big scenes, and I'm like, you're our antagonistic force, this is what this is about. And then you're like, nope, you're a small fry. Or there's a lots of lovely scenes of our character going to this pub with her friend, and her friend's looking at the guy, and she's like, oh, you should chat to her. And it almost, how do I put this? Imagine if in Twilight, you'd actually were semi-fooled into thinking the human school friends were part of the plot for a bit. Not because, and that's not bad.
Yeah, if you're like, you're a big Anna Kendrick fan, you're like, I can't wait to find out what's going to happen with her.
Yes, and obviously that's kind of a good thing, because I was fooled, because it's well written and a nice, there is development there, but almost too much if they're not actually going to be important, if you kind of get what I'm going for.
Now, Duncan, I will say that if you are really locked into the romance between Zuzana and Rick, and is it Rick? No, Mick. Lainey Taylor actually did write a short novella just about their first date.
Oh, that's really cute. Okay, I might seek that one out. That's commitment, though.
I might too, actually. I bet that's fucking adorable.
I like the idea that, like, even if they're not part of the big fantasy epic, they are equally important to Lainey Taylor as characters, and she's just as in love with those characters as she is with her fantastical characters. And that's what I think really makes this feel different to, say, Twilight, is there's sort of equal love going around.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, something which I feel like she does a wonderful job of is that she creates worlds that feel like they're vibrant and they're full and they're exciting. That's part of why I'm really excited to get to the next book, to actually go to the other world, to have Karu go there and go on adventures and see stuff, not through recollection or through Akiva's eyes, but to actually go to them herself. You know, like, we get the mundane world in Strange the Dreamer, and that's part one. It's like the first quarter of the book. But then the rest of the book is going on a really grand adventure and falling in love and solving mysteries.
So let's kind of expand on this narrative that we've been dancing around. This book follows the character of Karu. She is a young woman studying art in Prague. She is a bit aloof. She has a good friend there.
She's actually younger than I thought she was. When I didn't read the blurb of the book, I just started reading. I would have thought she was 19, 21 years old. Turn over the blurb, she's 17. And I did not believe that for a second.
It's interesting how that's only a 4-year difference, which if someone said, is my character I've written 46 or 50? You go, well, does it really matter? But at that age, you're like, no, that's very critical. She has a lot of maturity and confidence for that point. And I don't think it really plays in. Like, she could easily have been that bit older. In the, what, you know, for the UK, we consider university age.
Exactly, because she goes to university. So that's a bit of a hint. She goes to a lyceum. I don't know what the equivalent of that is.
But, Geordie, it's not just all drawing art pictures of her ex-boyfriend. She's got some magic in her. In fact, she has had a bit of a magical upbringing. Because our young Karu was raised by... let me get this right. A chimera shopkeeper called Brimstone, who has a magical teleporting shop who collects teeth of different creatures, including human, of the lowliest scum of Earth, and sells basically magic wishes in exchange for these teeth. And this isn't some like... I mean, the parallels to the Tooth Fairy, but not in like an organized way, in a very back alley, someone's gonna steal your liver kind of attitude. And she works...
He, like, deals with organ harvesters.
And Kerry works as his carrier. She sometimes goes and does collections. She sometimes goes to auction to buy particularly rare, ancient... is it like a saber-toothed tiger or something? It's teeth. She's like, here's some money, go and buy this for me. And that's sort of it. There's a bit of a mystery going. We don't know a lot about the background or how his magic work or what he's responding to. And that's sort of the initial mystery, is the fact that this chimera demonic-looking guy raised the baby, runs his shop, but we don't know what the further magical world is at this point. That's kept under wraps for sort of the first third. Did that intrigue you? What did you get? What was your guess, Geordie? Did you have like an early kind of, oh, I think it might be this?
Well, yeah, because I've read Strange Dreamer and they exist in the same world, or continuum rather. And that's something that I feel like we have to address now. If you are interested in his book, and you should be, you may choose to stop listening here because we're going to get into spoilers. We both recommend this book. We think it's very good. I'm excited to read on and read the future books. If you like romance in your fantasy, then go for this book. If you like vivid, imaginative worlds, go for this book. But if you're interested in all of those things, maybe you should read Strange for Dreamer first, before this one. Duncan, I'd like your opinion. Obviously, this was written first. Which do you think would be the better introduction to the cosmology and to the book as a whole?
That's a good question. It has to be Strange the Dreamer, Geordie.
Yeah, I agree.
I know it has to be, and it has to be for sort of one very key reason. Now, I'm not going to lie, reading just Daughter of Smoke and Bone on its own, the sort of cosmology, the connection between the novels, it's not something that will hit you over the head. I think it's not like, you know, this was written first. I don't think it's something that will massively complete in this first book. But you should definitely read Strange the Dreamer first. And to be honest, Geordie, just for one reason. Just for one simple reason.
It's better.
It's the better book.
Yeah.
By a country mile.
They're good books, but that one's way better than this one.
I would even say, and I know Geordie doesn't agree with me on this, Strange the Dreamer, I enjoyed so much more than its sequel, Muse of Nightmares. And reading A Daughter of Smoke and Bone, I actually think I preferred this slightly more than Muse of Nightmares, or like on a plane. But Strange the Dreamer was just that one absolute bolt of lightning, just so far ahead of the pack. I don't know what quite happened. The stars aligned. That book is incredible. So definitely read it first.
Yeah, but it's not like you can read Strange Dreamer and then not read Muse of Nightmares, because again, it ends on a humongous cliffhanger.
No, but I'd like to meet the person that did. They just went, that's all I need.
You see, reading a book, He goes, shame, closes it, leaves, that's it.
Shame they didn't write more in this book. I'm not paying for the ending I should have got in the first book. I'm sure someone has that attitude.
The other reason I would say that reading Strange Dreamer trumps reading this one is that, one, knowing how the worlds work in this book, knowing that they're connected, would ruin the mystery of Strange Dreamer. Like, once you know there are other worlds where magical stuff happens, you're like, okay, well, I know why there's magical beings in the sky. A lot of the mystery is gone there. There's also, like, a lot of the ideas are actually recycled between these books, which is fine, but it undermines it because when you read Stranger Dreamer and you're introduced to these ideas, you're like, oh, this is fresh and original and I don't know what's going on. But, like, for example, the gods in Stranger Dreamer sort of weaponizing having children in order to, like, make an army of magical beings, that's done here as well with the Seraphs. And you're just like, oh, you just sort of did the same thing again. And the main character having a, like, wackier but very cute best friend who fulfills her romantic relationship before she does, that's also done in Stranger Dreamer. And I feel like you would enjoy both of these books more reading it. Stranger Dreamer, Muse of Nightmares, and then this book.
And like I said, those two points that Joyce, you just drawn in comparison to, the weaponizing of having children and the quirky friend, just both points, I'm like, yeah, I enjoyed this more in Strange the Dreamer. But what does Daughter of Smoke and Bone have to offer? I think it does have some, you know, a bit of unique character here. I particularly enjoyed, as the world starts to open up, we get the introduction of our love interests. Now, Jordy, at what point did you realise the love interest is introduced initially as a threat? This angel being comes down with a magic sword while our character is sort of dealing with one of the customers of Brimstone. And he's here to do business. He's here to take names. At what point did you know definitively it was the love interest and not to worry? Was it as quick as in Bonesmith or a bit slower?
Oh, it's quicker because, again, to talk about the first thing you read, before you get to chapter one, you have to get through the sort of prologue line, once upon a time, an angel and a devil fell in love. It did not end well. And you're like, okay, well, I know what this book's about. So it's not a secret. It's laid out there even before you get to chapter one.
But our main character isn't a devil.
Well, she was, previously.
Spoilers, but yes, you're very much right.
The only thing I was wondering, as he appeared in the story, was like, okay, which one are you? Are you the angel or are you the devil? I rather hope, since you're initially appearing as the bad guy, that you're going to be the angel in the equation, just so we get a bit of, ooh, topsy-turvy stuff, bad guy angel. Yeah, there's no question when he shows up, because he's instantly entranced by how beautiful she is. You're like, okay, sure. You're a romantic hero. Okay, I get that. Even though you're chasing her with a sword and she's blasting you with magical eye beam powers.
No, you're right. It doesn't leave much to the imagination on that front. But there's certainly a nice question of, well, how are they going to come together? One thing that I was a bit curious of, until we got a bit more reveals near the end of the novel, is the fact that this angel, after this first encounter, our main character gets away, and the angel's literally there like, this woman, I must seek her out. I can't describe it, but I have such strong feelings. I was like, what's going on? Why? This feels a little too contrived. You know, is it destiny?
Yes, it does. Is it the universe? And that's, yeah, the insta-love element of this book is probably its weakest element by far. There doesn't really feel like there's a compelling reason for him to be interested in her, such that the book actually sort of picks up and improves when he vanishes from it for a bit, because it sort of takes you outside of this slightly contrived plot device to instead focus on Karu's adventures in the real world, tracking down bad guys. that's what sort of keeps the book fresh and interesting and exciting.
And this leads back to my kind of comments earlier, how this book did keep me guessing in the first half of what type of book it was going to be. So there's a certain incident where Karu's kind of ripped from her safety. The magical shop gets attacked, it gets destroyed, and she's on her own. You know, she doesn't have that, I was going to say guardian angel, which is not an appropriate phrase. She doesn't have her demonic superiors to fall back on in times of need. And this is something that's played up in the first or third in the novel, is this idea where she's running from danger and she's just got to get back to the magic shop, the teleporting magic shop. And that's her safety. And obviously that gets destroyed. She's on her own and she's going around the world. Basically, all those people who sold teeth and got given wishes in return. Wishes are like a physical, it's almost like, I think it's described like a coin that you use.
Yeah.
She's going to go around and she's going to collect them forcefully, she has to basically launch whatever counterattack, mission, rescue. I don't think she really has a plan other than, let's gather power, I will be better off with it than without it. And I'm like, oh, is this the book? Am I going to learn more about the types of people who have been buying wishes, who have been using wishes? Is this Kill Bill? Genuinely my kind of thought process at this point. Yeah. I was like, because we get a very detailed scene where she goes and visits this guy out in the woods, you know, all loaded up with his guns. What are you doing here? I live off grid. This cool kind of standoff with him. And it gets resolved and she gets some as a magical flying ability. And then that's sort of the end of that subplot. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like a little vignette. It almost felt like something out of like a sort of PG version of Library at Mount Shah.
Yes, I kind of get what you mean. It's I love that you say PG. I think that's a very key word to throw in there. Also, I saw the other day, Geordie, not to go completely off track again, I was very happy to see that I'm a avid Reddit user, and r/fantasy did their like poll. And the Library at Mount Char ranked really highly. So
wonderful. That's good. It's well deserved. It's a great book.
I don't know. I think I was more surprised. Not that it wasn't good, but I just didn't realise it was that widely acclaimed. But maybe I don't move in the right circles. It's not something that gets... I think it's because people can't go, you like Brandon Sanderson, you're like this. Which seems to be the default
absolutely
position.
Yeah.
Go and check out our review on Library at Mount Char.
Yeah, I wonder how it's getting passed around. Yeah, unless it's very popular amongst fans of Harry Dresden. The Dresden Files, that's it.
I mean, we'll have to read those books to find out.
Do we, though? Okay, so I'll jump back in and say something about wishes in this book. Pretty much the main focus of magic in this book is all about wishes. And I really like the, like... denominations of wishes. Did you like how it was laid out, Dunk?
I did. There's quite a almost hard magic element to the wishes, in the sense that there's a very linear, discrete scale of wish making.
Exactly, yeah. There's like, it's literally framed as currency. You spend it to buy a wish, but it's made clear that there's a description of the smallest type of wish, scuppies, and she says they're like pennies, but unlike pennies you can't stack them, you know, you can't combine scuppies until they become a shing or a luck. Now the scale of wishes is scuppy for really small wishes, then it goes shing, luck now, gavriel, and finally the big wish, bruxis.
Now, I'm not educated enough to know whether or not these are just made-up magical fantasy nonsense words, or if there's some root meaning being deployed here.
So, I'm looking at the Daughter of Smoke and Bone wiki page now. So, luck now initially appears to just be the word luck now, which is good because, you know, you're buying luck in that instant moment. But it points out that it's the name of a city in India, so I guess it's sort of like a pun. But the best one is bruxis may come from the word bruxism, which is a term used to describe the grinding of teeth and clenching of the jaw.
Oh, very nice. Well, I'm quite just impressed of how it's been put together. There's also a little bit of leeway in terms of, obviously there's a scale. What comes into each scale, it's not like absolutely laid out for you, the reader. There's sort of just offhanded comments of like, oh, I could do that, yeah, but I need a whole one of these to pull that off.
But there is some internal consistency. Like, for example, there's a point in the book where it's mentioned the main character can speak 20 languages, and you're like, okay, that's cringe. That's a little, like, Mary Sue-ish. Like, your main character is so special, she can speak all these languages. But it has a really solid reason, which is that you can spend one of these luck coins to learn a language, to just suddenly know it. And that's actually kind of clever, and that's reused very dramatically later in the book. So it's set up as a sort of weird thing she can do, why she's so special, an explanation is provided, and then it's used in an interesting way in the text of a story.
That's really just how you want to see it. It's how I love seeing the application of magic systems and the benefit of when you try and do a magic system that is a bit harder, which when it's wishes, you always think would go against that. It would be, excuse the pun, wishy-washy. But that's how you want it. That's when I read, like, and really enjoy, like, in a Brandon Sanderson, you know, you have a magical power, the rules are clearly defined, but then you get to see it used in innovative ways throughout the text. This is a perfect example of that. And when that came up, there's that moment later on in the book when that kind of pays off was actually, I'd say, in many respects, the most kind of like punch the air kind of moment for our main character. I was like, yes, you do that. And I love that because the moment is she learns a language and just surprise people. It's that classic when people talk to you in when you, you've seen, there's probably 100 of these things on YouTube. It's sad.
Yeah, but when everyone's talking to you, go, oh, I can speak YouTube your language too. Of white man speaks perfect Mandarin Chinese and astonishes shopkeeper.
Do you know what? Like, you say all that. Now, the only example I can think of is in like Rush Hour 1. Yes, this book does a Rush Hour 1. That old Jackie Chan movie. And if you know that reference, good for you. If not, go and watch the movie. It probably hasn't aged that well.
Probably. Rush Hour 2 definitely has not. I could not. Me and my mates watch it at a like, not a sleepover. We're grown men. We were hanging out in the evening.
In your pajamas.
And we tried to watch it again, and we were like, wow, this is so racist.
Gosh, it was an attempt by sort of the Hollywood system to make a Jackie Chan movie. And you're like, ah, this is what happens. You try to make it funny and instead just make it more racist. That's very telling of the times.
Yeah, it was also made by Brett Ratner, so that should speak to it.
So, where were we? Brilliant moment. And we get this or magic system, and I'm just going to jump to the spoiler. So this magic system our character uses throughout, and there's a great kind of running theme of brimstone, the chimera is what they're called, demonic, edge of the spectrum, father figure, who always chastises her for like using them wantonly and without a lot of thought.
Wishy-washy.
And she always says, like, well, you know, they're mine to spend. You know, why does it matter so much how I use them? And the character uses them quite a few times throughout the whole book. And then later on, we get this beautiful reveal, which when I found out, I was like, that, like, works. That makes sense. It's a twist, but it now makes sense when I backdate it to a thing I've already found out, is that it's not about teeth. It's not about teeth being inherently, like, magical on their own. It's about pain. And it's about suffering.
Mm.
And that's the power of pain and suffering that drives magic.
Exactly.
And
but this is also used in a really interesting way later. And again, this is like in the sort of hard magic. It's a set rule of how something's used, but then we flex it to make it interesting. Magic is fueled by pain. And the main male character, Akiva, has a wound in his shoulder, which gives him constant chronic pain. But he uses his chronic pain to fuel magic. So he always has a supply of magic at his disposal.
Now I deeply want that kind of House spin-off where he becomes a sorcerer. I think that'd be good.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Dr. House Blood Mage. To be honest, the series wouldn't actually get that much weirder considering the number of strange diseases he comes across.
No, I think more so I'm going to have to channel it. One day I'm going to just create a D&D character that's just going to be a reskinned version of House and see how that flies. Yes, and
okay,
it works really well, though, this concept of painting magic, because then our main character gets this sort of backdated compiling of guilt for all of the little things that in the early novel we're very much on her side for. There's this funny scene early on where her ex-boyfriend is doing a pose, what's it called? Is it still life?
Life drawing.
Life drawing class. And she uses these little wishes to give him like a little itch. One on his nose, one on his elbow. And then she makes him want to scratch his ass in front of the class. Very funny, light and amusing. And now you're like, oh my gosh, who suffered for that? Who felt pain?
Yeah, exactly. One of the ways you get Abraxas, the only way you can get Abraxas, the main wish, which Karu needs in order to be able to fly, is you have to extract all of someone's teeth.
Yeah, it's quite horrific. There is a bit I was a bit confused at, though. Mostly because there are scenes where I believe a character is basically grave digging to extract teeth. And I'm like,
I don't think it has to be like present suffering. I think it's more it's the sort of humiliation of the dead that sort of counts in that case. Like, you're still removing parts of a body.
I suppose so. And then obviously it just plays into the next question, which is, surely by this logic, like, dentists are like the greatest sorcerers. At no point is any of the people she does business in are just normal dentists setting up shop somewhere.
Well, they have to throw away their teeth because it's medical waste.
Yeah, I'm just saying, a dodgy dentist charges low amounts. No, can't drill that one out. I'll have to tug it.
Yeah, really, her hookup should have been the dentist from Little Shop of Horrors.
Yes. Yes! Oh, I haven't seen that in ages. I would love to rewatch that. Have you ever seen the original? Like the non-musical version?
No, I don't. I haven't.
It's interesting, I think, more so to see like two very similar tellings of the same story. I do recommend it. But if you've already seen the musical version, I do recommend. Just also to see, because it was on a much lower budget. So it's fun to see like the same effects pulled off, but less well, let's say. Probably very well, given the budget. Sorry. Now, this is a great reveal, and this is when the story really kind of kicks off. Because now the magical elements really start to step into the world, and we know the story's going now. We know that it's about Kiru and the angel Akifa?
Akifa.
Yeah. They team up, and they have a very nice, classic... I don't know, I was about to call it a meet cute, second meet cute, where Kiru is thinking he's hunting her down, thinking he's hunting her down with the intention to do harm, and she's running through the streets of Prague, and she bumps into the woman that her ex cheated on her with, and she's like, it's like, really get into the corner, someone's hunting me, what's going on? And I just think it's this really nice scene where she lunges out to attack him. And he just has this whole, like, attitude of, well, what are you doing? No, I'm peaceful. And she just keeps trying to hit him. Like, and it goes on, like, to exactly. A next level. But then this best bit is then he's like, right, I need to step back from this. So wings come out. He flies up into the air. He's an angel. And he's like, okay, now we've got some distance. Can we? And then she flies. Like, I don't think it's the first time.
Yeah,
just...
because in the previous scene, she's wished the ability to fly, and this is the first person she's showing it to. So they start to have a in midair kung fu fight.
And this is confounded by the fact that then her ex-boyfriend, like, comes round the corner. And if I'm not mistaken, I think this is a great little description for this character. He's like, he's not bewildered, he's not scared, he's not like worried or whatever. All he is jealous. She's showing this man more attention as they kung fu fight in the air.
Exactly. That is a good illustration of the moment. I did like that a lot. And what I like about this too is that it's this scene where Akiva and her are fighting. They've had a fight before and it was like a like swords out, trying to kill each other thing. She's on the defensive. And I really like the fact that Lainey Taylor immediately flips the script by having being completely non-combative, only trying to evade, sustaining a lot of harm from her. She has tattoos in her palms, which look like Hamsas, which is the sort of classic hand with two thumbs with the eye there to cast away evil. And she's using these to like hurt him, because they hurt him every time she points them at him. And he refuses to hurt her back. And the only thing he does to sort of like stop her is he grabs her hands and he like puts them together and then holds her hands. So that's his big finishing move, is that they have to hold hands. And so, you know, isn't that nice and sweet? The only way to end the fight is to do something soft, gentle and affectionate.
No, it's just really cleverly done. It's really nice tying in to the overall themes of their kind of relationship into the action. Again, it's one of those things where I'm just like, Niani Taylor, you are talented. Well done. Can I actually just take a moment, before we get into the next book, the next bit I think we're really going to talk about the fantasy world and the background and the expansion of lore and all of that, which was a great rush when this sort of started happening. Can I just say, this book was a really nice read. Like, Niani Taylor, even in this book, you know, sure. I know Strange Dreamer, I think, is damn poetic, but this book was still like a very relaxing, like I felt like I was just flicking through the pages, very little effort, it wasn't too tiring. Again, there were moments where I was like, oh, what is happening? As in, I don't think anything has happened for 8 pages. But it wasn't a hard, wasn't a strain.
The chapters are very short.
Some, intentionally so.
The chapters are very short.
There were amazing ones where...
Some are beautifully short, for like a poem.
Which I was just like, oh, beautiful, beautiful. There's one that's like a sentence. There's like one moment after a critical moment in the plot that we're building and building to. We then get a whole chapter on its own page that is literally just like one sentence being like, oh my god, I can't even remember the line now. Damn it, Geordie, I should know this. No, I want to quote it.
It's Snap.
Snap.
Yeah, it's about breaking the wishbone. The chapter is called Snap, and it's just describing the feeling of the wishbone snapping. That's it. That's the entire chapter. It's like 2 sentences long. It's beautiful. And the next page is also one chapter, and it's like one paragraph. And then the next page is like a page and a bit, and then we start to get back towards more normal chapter lengths. But she really starts to play with using chapters not even to break up the story, but to break up sensation. It's that chapter is just about the physical sensation of the bone being pulled apart. But the next chapter is just about the physical sensation of the magic sort of channeling within her. And then the next chapter is about memories flooding into her, and it only focuses on the sensation of the memories. So it's really beautiful use, not even of language, but just of form.
It's just an author using structure to sell the feeling, to get the investment. Like, everyone knows, it's like taught in, like, I'm gonna say in an average 12-year-old's English class, they'll tell you that like short punchy sentences are good for sometimes like building tension or action, you know, keep them short. To see someone then keeping the chapters short and then using how that might be printed to both give you a moment but also give you a breath. Because when you get that whole chapter, you turn the page, you have to pause as a reader to turn that page. You read that one sentence, and then you have to take another moment before you then turn the page and get the next bit. Just don't see it very often, and I really appreciate when I do. It's a step beyond, I think, even what we saw, say something like The Neverending Story, where actual layout on the page is played with. Well, that's great. I say a step beyond. A step in the same field, using the actual format to progress the point, because this is something where I'm like, well, anyone could do this. I can think of loads of books where you could use this technique, but it's not common and it's not widely used. And that makes it so special.
The only thing I can think of to compare would be a series of unfortunate events. And I can give two examples. One is that he says the character is about to mess around with electric wiring. And he says, now, of course, dear reader, you must never, ever, ever, ever. And then does two full pages of just the word ever mess around with electricity. And another one is a scene where the lights go out and like the page is just full black ink. No words, just black.
Oh, that's fun. Oh, that's a thing. I'm trying to think of it. That is good. I really do appreciate it, because it's something that I feel like could be done all the time, but isn't. And almost, why not? Our editor's saying don't do that, or it's just... I do understand how, actually, I can think of one critique, because obviously then it does draw attention to the medium that you're experiencing the story through. You're no longer in another place with these characters. You're very much aware, you know, you're holding the book in your hand. So I think that could be the only reason I'd be like, well, that's a downside to this technique. But overall, I think because I see it so rarely, so when sure. I do see it, it's often done very well. I just love it. So again, 10 out of 10.
I'll say one more thing on this front. A great example of someone taking advantage of their medium in a very smart way is the Chaos Walking series. You know what I'm talking about, Duncan? Starting with The Knife of Never Letting Go.
I actually don't. Should I be ashamed of that fact?
No, you shouldn't be ashamed of it. They are very good books. Duncan, I would recommend them to you because I know you would like them. You have to read them in a physical book. No, you could read them on Kindle, but you have to read them in a looking at the page format. Because what that book does, what the book series does, is it uses language and spelling and font in very interesting ways. The first book has a sort of scrappy, non-traditional font, and almost every word in the book is misspelt because the main character is illiterate. So its sentence structures are incredibly simple. Things are stated plainly. The language is incorrect and wrong. But also, there's a very interesting aspect of our book called The Noise. This book takes place on a planet where all living things create something called noise, which is just their thoughts are projected outwards. And noise is written in a specific style of font. It's very wild and big. And the author will play with that by like layering text on top of each other to show a very chaotic scene. But it goes beyond this, because sometimes when noise is very well structured, the font changes and becomes very clear and stark and strong. And when the next book happens, a second POV character is introduced. She writes in a different font and her words are perfectly spelt. And as the series goes on, our character, main character Todd, grows up, but is also sort of indoctrinated, and his language and his spelling improves. Not only is he shown to be growing up, the way he thinks is changing, and that's shown through the text as well. Now, one other thing it does, which is just good fun, is that if there's a big explosion, he does it in big font. So if it goes boom, he writes in a big boom letters. So much so that I believe in the second book, there is a black line on the side of the page where the boom is so large that it just goes off the page and you get to see the side of the M.
I mean, that does sound wonderful. As you're talking about it, I'm now thinking of more and more examples. I'm like, oh, Terry Pratchett plays with it with the death character, and I used to read Del Toro Quest. But anyway, still, should be played with more, is my opinion. That's my hot take for today.
Yeah, definitely.
I want more people playing with font and structure and the layout on the page. Back to Daughter of Smoke and Bone.
Now then, let's move on towards resolving the mystery, resolving the romance, and wrapping up this book.
So, Georgie, you mentioned the wishbone, and this plays into an essential part of the book, which is talking about solving the mystery of Karu, her origins, and why Akifa is so madly, immediately in love with her.
And this is laid out in an interesting way because the information is drip, drip, dripped out in front of us. We learn very early on, even in Akiva's first scene, where we get it from his perspective, that he suffered a great loss. He's lost someone called Madrigal. He's so moody and sad and glum because the love of his life has died. It's only very slowly and gradually that he starts to associate this with the woman in front of him. And you have no reason to believe at this point that his partner isn't anyone except another Seraph, another angel. But then there's actually a very big revelation that it's revealed that Madrigal is actually a chimera. She's the enemy. She is the devil to his angel.
Now, Geordie, I'm going to tell you something. I had a theory.
Okay.
I had something what I thought would be the twist. I had a guess. And I was wrong. Just put that out there. I want to know if you had similar thoughts, or at least you can say, don't worry, Duncan, that's not too mad.
Go ahead.
Because we know that our angel character, he's like 50 years old. That's established quite early on. And our main character was 17.
Yeah.
And our angel character had a former love who is now dead. I generally thought for quite a bit that maybe Kiri was going to turn out to be his daughter. And that was going to be the twist. I know. And they got to a point where I just went, now, Leanne Taylor, if you are going to make that the twist, I think we've been a bit gross and we should stop this now. So please don't let that be the twist. But that really did seed in my brain for a good bit of this novel.
Who do you think wrote this book? Cassandra Clare? Some people got that.
Not me.
And you never will, Duncan.
No, that's not the twist.
All right, that's not the twist. That's not the twist. This would be a very different book if it was. But they are connected. This is laid down in such a drip-drip way that I think us as readers are definitely getting there before Karu is. I think the moment that it sort of clocks in, you're like, okay, I think I know what's happening here, is when he sees the wishbone and something clicks in his head. He figures something out. But not before. No, no, the opposite of that. Just before his brother and sister show up and his fellow soldiers, and they're like, we were wondering why you left your post, and now we're wondering why you're crying on this human woman, and hey, why does she have evil hamsters on her hands? That's bad. And then they'd have to run. He has to fight his own family to defend her, and she vanishes off to Morocco so that they can go into his world together, with her being on a mission to find her family, who is locked up within a black fortress in his world. So that's what they're going to meet up to do. But when he shows up, his mood is very different. It's very grim, and it's not revealed to us why is he so sad. Why is he so convinced that she's going to hate him?
Now, this was very well done because the author, Leanne Taylor, clearly knows that you want them to break the wishbone and the answer be revealed. This is setup. Now, the wishbone, by the way, is introduced earlier as a magical item given to her by her step demon father. Just put that out there. Also, while they're on the bridge, that's the epic I speak your language moment. Yeah. Where she's like, I speak angelic. Great class. But this built up, and I love the fact because they're going to break the wishbone, but then they keep talking for a bit. And this keeps playing to the point where the actual last line before they break the wishbone is literally Leontina going, and then finally, they broke the bone. Like, so she knows she's playing with you. And that's when we then dive into our structure. But Geordie, oh, the mystery is there. It finally happens. I love this moment. It's so well written. It's the snap. And then all the lore gets dropped on you.
Yeah.
Now, what I really like is, firstly, is that we, instead of this being like an exposition scene, we jump back. This is all done as flashbacks, so we're still part of the characters in the moment as this background's been explained, which I think is the complete right decision. If you're going to tell me about ancient past, just give me a POV in the past.
That's definitely true. But what's done you're right to say that we go back to the characters and we play it out with them, and that is a great way to extract this information. But what I think it does very prudently is that it essentially, the memories happen and it gives you the cliff notes of what she remembers before it happens. So she says she remembers being her former self, because we find out that she's basically like a reincarnation. We find out that she did indeed fall in love with Akiva. We find out that they were caught, and we find out that she was executed. And these are all like, given to us in like almost bullet point form as memories that come rushing back to her. And then we go through with this mounting sense of dread. We now know what's going to happen, but we get to enjoy seeing it all unfold. And it just so happens that this is the best bit of the book, because there's some really good saucy chemistry in this scene. Akiva has been very distant with Karu, deliberately so. He's not been upfront with her, and he is damaged, and he's distant. But we get to meet young, idealistic Akiva, who's full of love, and he's vibrant. So we get to see him at his very best, being romantic and gentlemanly and sweet.
To put it another way, this is the transition from Twilight into A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Yeah. Well said, Duncan. Yes, that's actually very... Yes, you've done it. You've hit it right on the head. We go from...
This is why I really like this book. It really does feel like it straddles coming out in between those two series. Mm. This book felt like it took me through that transition. I went from having my stoic, distant... Elric style, whoa is me, beautiful angel, and now I get to see my hot, charming, we're at the masquerade ball, darling, kind of man, this idyllic youth who gets a bit giddy still, despite the fact that of his, you know, yes, they're still scarred with experience, and they're both mature, and they both know the world's a harsh place, but they're just so excited and passionate to be together. It is a fantastic end of the novel, in such a way where it feels like a completely different novel, but it's still a really good one.
Interesting you bring up Elric now, Duncan, because we get our fourth, count it, our fourth white wolf of the podcast.
We do indeed. The leader, I think, the head of the Chimera, who are the more demonic race, their leader command, is called the White Wolf. Second in command, sorry, you're right, the Warlord's different character. He is the White Wolf, and you're like, I wonder who you were inspired by. How many White Wolves? What are the White Wolves, by the way? So we've got Elric, we've got Geralt. We've got this bloke.
Jon Snow.
There's our
four? That's everyone I know.
Wow. We haven't actually done, by the way, Game of Thrones, so maybe we can't technically count it yet.
Well, and to be quite honest, Duncan, I didn't even get up to the point in Game of Thrones where I've heard anyone call him the White Wolf. You've just told me that he gets called that at some point. So presumably that's in book 5 or 6 or whatever. I got up to book 4.
They do call him that in the show, if you be at the end of season 6.
I don't remember that.
Maybe. Fair enough. Trust me, it's true. Because his brother's the young... Anyway... Yes, White Wolf, very popular. Also in Legend, in the Dresnia? The Drenai, thank you. The Drenai series, there's a White Wolf in that as well. I generally think I should set out to note these ones all down. But yeah, we get this character, and what we get is some really effective scenes. And we kind of do skip through their romance, but I think still giving quite... like enough time at each stage. The initial meeting is fantastic, by the way. The chronic pain. What happened? Because he was wounded on a battlefield after a fight, and this beautiful woman comes out of the mist, the enemy, but she heals him, she lets him live, and that is a wonder. I love that little seed of moment. It's almost I'm gonna say John Valjean-ish, to be honest, because you know, it's that little bit of kindness, and it gets in his head. He goes, why did she do that? They're not monsters. There's peace. We could have like all the idealism is born out of this tiny seed of her not killing him on the battlefield, but you know, helping him with his wounds. But it also swings the seed of his love. He's like, I must find this face again. I must experience, find out who this person is. And so he goes on his quest to find her. Then we jump over to Madrigal. And we see things from her perspective. And it's almost like it's a full narrative. We see her playing off her close friend and their concerns and their thoughts. You know, she's so beautiful. Her friend's like, I wish I was beautiful for you. Oh, you're beautiful on the inside. Nice little moments. We see them getting ready to go to like the masked ball. We see her anxiety because they know that the White Wolf is wanting to, I don't know what the word is. I was about to say seduce. That's probably not the word. Arrange marriage her off. I don't even know it's that. Be a right court. That's still a too polite word. Be a creepy ass is what he plans to be. And her anxieties and the masquerade balls chapter, mate. I was like, this is fantastic. I wish I'd gotten to this sooner.
Yeah, this is fantasy. Like in Stranger Dreamer where they go into the dreams. This is where just this boundless imagination just gets unleashed. You know, like, here's something I really loved. You know, they're an animal society, you know, and so they all have like potent senses of smell and sight. You know, something they do is young lovers will powder themselves with sugar so that their partner can like sniff it and lick them. And I thought, like, you know what? That's actually so, like, that feels so real that I feel like people could actually do that in real life. That feels like just like I've a learned new something about idea. You, Jordy. Well, I'm not going to lick people at parties. Thank you very much. It just feels like something people might actually do.
No, I see where you're coming from. And it feels very much like we finally stepped through the looking glass and we're in this beautiful masquerade, but everyone's already like this chimera hybrid magical creature anyway. It's so much fun and so colourful and such a contrast to the real world narrative of the first two thirds of the novel. Not saying that Prague isn't obviously a wonderful place, but it doesn't compare to this magical fantasy land. This plays out. I adore it. I love the fact that she bumps into him at the masquerade ball. He's all romantic and charming and all that. And then there's the villain coming down. She's like, I don't want to be seen by him. And he's like, quickly come with me. We shall elope together. Let's run away from this party scene and go somewhere quiet. It's just so well done. It's giving you what, or at least it gave me, what I kind of wanted out of this.
Yeah.
And I really can't critique it. And then you've got the quiet moment where they're away and they're telling stories of each, they're sharing their culture, we're learning about the lore. Mm-hmm. But it seems very natural. That's what they would do. They're just getting to know each other for the first time. They don't know. They were sworn enemies. They don't even know the fundamentals of their belief systems yet. And they're sharing and they're talking and they're aspiring for a better world. And it felt very both hyper romantic, but not contrived. And I think that's very fine line to weave here. And it really impressed me. To be pretty honest, Jordy, the only problem I have with this later part of the book is it kind of made me go, oh, I wish this was more of the book.
Well, Duncan, if you wanted that to be more of the book, I've got a great recommendation for you. It's a little book. You might have heard of it. It's called Strange the Dreamer.
Yes, you know what, Jordy? I do have vague recollections of that, having extensive scenes of two lovers running through these dreamlike states and it being both poetic and magical, yet grounded and real. And Leonie Taylor is good. Like, she is a good, damn good author. And when she's doing what she does best, it's truly amazing. There's other narrative around it, but this is why I think you would read this book, is to get to this stuff.
Of course, nothing good can last. We already had a premonition of how it all goes wrong. They are betrayed by her sister. They're arrested. Akiva is tortured. She is executed. But Brimstone, who is both the father figure to Karu and to Madrigal, has a plan. And he tells her that, like, okay, you know how. By the way, we're going to mention this. His job in their world is he brings dead bodies back to life. And the only reason that the war between the Seraph and the Chimera can continue is that he is bringing people back to life using the teeth, which she brings him. in a real world. He tells her, like, okay, there's a secret way I can bring you back to life if you do X, Y, and Z. Something about this scene I like is the fact that, you know, spoilers for Stranger Dreamer, when Sarai dies, there's a bit in it where she's like, oh, I can't do anything. I can't return to my body because I have no way to propel myself as a spirit before I evanesce. And then in this book, before that problem is even, like, introduced in the, later on in the continuum, it's like, actually, there totally was a way that you could have survived that, Sarai. So that's a skill issue, actually.
It's a will issue. You just weren't motivated enough.
You just need to have a high enough motivation and be next to a body which is, like, a little bit empty so you can swoop right into that. And then this is all obviously brought home. She is awoken. She now has all her memories back. She finds out that she was raised as a baby by Brimstone because he basically brought his protege back to life and then got to raise her to be a child, to grow up, to eventually get her memories back. And it seems like all is well now. You know, she and Akiva are finally back together. They've fallen in love in two different lifetimes. And at last, they're going to be together. So why does Akiva look so sad?
Now, I was sat there thinking, can I also just say, this is partly why I was like, oh, what's happened? What does she still not know? And you're on these sort of tender hooks. And I really enjoyed, oh, by the way, actually, sorry, sidetrack again. I keep doing this episode. Did you ever have a bit of a concern that we were reading two different characters? This might seem ridiculous, but when you get to know Karu on her own, and now she's like getting loaded this new character into her mind, I'm very interested to see how that plays off going forward, just because I felt that they were both still quite distinct characters. Magical in the flashbacks and Karu, I felt like still acted differently. I wouldn't say they seem to be the one and the same person, despite that clearly being the point. Did you ever have any of that vibe?
I was concerned about what it would be like when she was one person again. Whether we would sort of end up with, you know, 2 + 3 = 5, and we'd end up with 5 and not really know who that character was. I don't think it's really going to matter that much going forwards. I think it's not going to be 2 + 3 = 5. I think it's going to be 2.5. I think it's going to average out.
Fair enough. I don't really have any. I think it was just something that's watched into my head. I went, I hope Karu, when we get back to her, is still recognisably Karu. Because I like Karu, but Karu with more knowledge.
Duncan?
Yes, Dordy.
Why is he so sad?
Oh, because they're dead, Dordy.
He fucking lied. You know, when he met up with her again, he didn't know that she had any, like, actual proper connection to Brimstone, aside from that, like, she was their employee. So he lied to her. He said, when I burnt the shop down, I don't even think he takes ownership of that. I think it's like, when the shop got burnt down, Brimstone and co. got put in jail. They got taken away. But no. He killed them. He killed all of them. He killed her parents. The main love interest murdered her family.
It's so, like, tragic, because you're like, you could have just been happy if you just hadn't been such a dick. Yeah. And he does half explain it, and you're like, yeah, it. You know, he's trying to Romeo and Juliet it, be like, I didn't get the message. What else was I going to do? Not murder your cousin. Anyway, Romeo's a dick. Exactly, this happens, and I genuinely had this moment of like, oh, how are they going to get through this? I am intrigued, because now I'm like,
I'm intrigued too.
Do you forgive him? You shouldn't forgive him. I wouldn't forgive him. But then again, I do want you to be together, but I want you to be with him who was the him before he did the thing. Now he's done the thing. Can we go back? I don't know. Can you go back? What do you decide? And as you with the character and me as a reader, would it be the same thing? Because I'm not going to lie, Jordy, I hate it when I'm not on the same page as the character. Because if she forgives him and I don't forgive him as a reader,
oh,
that
yeah.
is
oh,
a bit
yeah.
of a deal breaker for me.
Yeah, I mean, we had this last time when we were like, why are you so cool with having been a slave? You should be angry about that.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. And it's something that I am deeply curious, like, how are you going to resolve this? How are you going to take it forward? This is a book that, very much like The Force Awakens, really sold
hopefully
me
it's
on
not
what's
like
going to
that.
Happen next.
And Duncan, that brings us... Yes, I want to see what happens next. Unquestionably, I am going to read the next book, Days of Blood and Starlight. It's there on my bookshelf, so I'm reading it. The question is, Duncan, under what context am I going to do that? I have served up a ball. I took a risk. I returned to a place that was familiar. I was genuinely very worried that this would not be good, and that would really upset me. But it was good. So, Duncan, what's next for the podcast? Are we going to read Days of Blood and Starlight?
I'll tell you now, Geordie, I have been inspired by reading this book. You picked it. You decided, let's revisit an author who we've already read a book from. A good, amazingly strong female author who we very much enjoyed the first thing we read. And you went, let's go back and read one of their previous works. That's a very good decision you made. I'm going to give you something very similar.
All right, I'm trying to think now. I'm trying to guess. We've read this person, but we haven't read their earliest work. I'm going through, and I'm drawing a blank. I'm not really sure what you're referring to.
I'm referring to the Enchanting in Every Sense, says Robin Hobb. Uprooted by Naomi Novik.
Oh, wait, what the fuck? We're reading a Naomi Novik book, but not the next Scholomance?
Oh, you can read that in your own time, mate. Come on. Move on. Fresh ground. New faces. Expand your mind.
I don't know about this. Uprooted. Okay. What's it about? What's it about? Come on. Explain yourself.
Oh my goodness, I've just flipped to the blurb and I'm kind of going, how do I pronounce these names? Agnieszka loves her village, set deep in a peaceful valley.
But the nearby enchanted forest casts a shadow over her home. Many have been lost to the woods, and none return unchanged. The villagers depend on an ageless wizard, the dragon, to protect them from the forest's dark magic. However, his help comes at a terrible price. A young village woman must serve him for 10 years, leaving all she values behind.
I'm not gonna lie, I'm actually not 100% sold by that blurb, which is a bit weird. I just highly recommend
it. Why did you pick the book then?
Because it had a nice cover.
Well, you know what? I reject this. I said I wasn't gonna do this on a matter of principle, but I've been insulted. I have been disgraced. I have been humiliated, Duncan. And I feel I have no choice. I'm spending one of my destiny points, and we're not reading that book. We're reading the next Scholomance.
Well, I guess you win.
I don't feel like I've won. I don't feel like I've won at all. I hope it's good. I've really been building it up. And I'll be honest, I don't really remember what happened to the first book anymore. I'm definitely going to have to refresh my memory. But that's what we're doing. So there.
Very well. Please join us next time for the second book in the Scholomance series by Naomi Novik, which is not called The Last Graduate.
I don't
can't
know what
remember its title.
It might be The Last Graduate. No, maybe not. Something about Golden Keys? Golden Keys?
It is called... No, it is The Last Graduate. My apologies. The last one's called The Golden Enclave.
The Last Graduate. Hey, look at that. She's graduating, which is crazy considering she's going to be in her second year.
It only says it'll be the last graduate. She might not graduate. Could be a dropout.
Ooh, sad.
I know. Sad times.
Dropout.
Right. If you have read The Daughter of Smoke and Bone or any other book by Leanne Taylor, if you read the whole trilogy, let us know your thoughts. How do you compare? Do you think I'm being ridiculous by saying it's this weird middle ground between Twilight and A Court of Thorns and Roses? Am I just not read well enough into the genre? Let me know. Tell us.
That might be the smartest thing you've ever said, Duncan.
Thank you. Tell us what you think about the Scholomance. Tell us if you're excited for us to go on and do the sequel at long last. 2 years, I think, Geordie's been waiting for this. Tell us if you feel disappointed that we're missing out on Uprooted. The always best way to contact us is our Instagram, Is This Fantasy Podcast. You can also reach us on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy, and our Gmail is always there, isthisfantasypodcast@gmail.com. It makes our day so much when you message us, even just saying you'd like to listen to us, or you thought that was a good idea, or Geordie was wrong. Let us know. It's always a delight.
Duncan, you know, the curious thing is that the series which Naomi Novik is most famous for is about the Napoleonic Wars fought with dragons, like a sort of dragon-riding hornblower. And that sounds way more like your thing than Uprooted does.
I think mostly for Uprooted, I kind of just thought, because it was a standalone, I went, that could work. I'd like to finish one of her works. Because just because we read The Last Graduate doesn't mean we're ever touching Golden Enclave.
I mean, don't I get to decide if we read Golden Enclave? Like, this is your choice, technically.
Well, I might start burning my own destiny tokens to forever keep you away. Out of spite, obviously. But it depends. If it's good enough, maybe.
We shall see. Okay. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
Till next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.